Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I'm Sammy Yenigan. You can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week on Culturetopia, NPR News put a new spin on an old chestnut, the end-of-the-year roundup. With the down economy and a series of natural disasters, it was a bad year for many in the U.S. But there are still people, businesses, and ideas that have done well. We've highlighted some of these ideas in a series called A Good Year. Along the way, NPR touched on topics from science to politics, from hip-hop to hell. Here are some of the cultural connections from our series.
Today we look at Korean pop music. NPR's Claudine Abade reports that this was the year that K-pop made it big in the U.S.
Need proof that K-pop has smashed through the U.S. market? Exhibit 1, Girls' Generations. They sold out Madison Square Garden. Nine leggy Korean girls made up as mannequins, moving in perfect unison. Sweet smiles plastered on their faces, wearing day glow yellow, green, and pink short shorts and heels with bobby socks. Girls' Generation may just epitomize the K-pop band. They're nothing if not formulaic. Lots of members. Not one is playing an instrument, and their dances are hyper-choreographed. And that video has been viewed more than 59 million times on YouTube. Which brings me to Exhibit 2, YouTube. You know, when you watch a YouTube video, there's a number showing you just how many times it's been viewed. Now, if you look next to it, there's a button you can click that shows a map of the world. The parts of that map that are shaded in green are where people are watching that video.
And just over in the last 2 years, you have a video from a Korean artist, and the map would be kind of green in Korea, and then would be light green in Asia.
That's David Marks with YouTube Asia Pacific.
And now the last couple singles that people like Girls' Generation have released, now just looking at those maps, they're just pure green everywhere, and it's kind of even surprising to us.
YouTube has just created a K-pop channel, and it's being bombarded by fans. Susan Kang runs the K-pop fan site Soompi. She says it's the videos that are driving the fan craze.
I think K-pop is just as much about like the image and the fashion and the dance as much as the music itself. It's really popular for people to learn like all the dances from the different music videos.
And Kang says fans love to upload videos of themselves doing the moves. And now Exhibit 3, Accolades. This song, Bubble Pop by Hyana, is number 9 on Spin's 20 Best Songs of 2011. And there's the MTV Iggy Award for the best new band in the world. It's decided by votes from fans. K-pop band 21 grabbed that award this year, and more than half of the votes came from the U.S. This 21 video, I Am the Best, shows off another side of K-pop. Strutting in vinyl cat suits, and at one point wielding silver machine guns, these girls are anything but sugar sweet. But they keep the K-pop formula, with moves that are in sync, on point, and totally polished. Their work caught the attention of musician and music producer Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. Earlier this year, he posted this video on YouTube praising the band.
I liked it a lot. I think you guys are real talented. I would like to work with you guys on some beats, on some music.
He's now in the process of producing 21's first English album. 2011 was a good year for K-pop. But superfan Susan Kang believes there's still more to come.
So this past year, I feel like we've just grazed the tip of the iceberg. K-pop is going to be a lot more in the forefront than it already is.
Considering the line of K-pop boy bands still waiting in the wings to show off their moves, this craze may just sink step right through 2012. Claudine Abade, NPR News.
Turn on the radio. 2011 was a good year for hell. Satan's domain has received a lot of press, from Hollywood to doomsday prophets to New York Times bestsellers. In fact, this year has seen an incendiary debate about the existence and contents of hell. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty takes the hot seat.
The year began with an epic battle between a priest and Satan.
It is God who commands you your name! Your name! Give me your name!
That's Anthony Hopkins playing a priest possessed by a major demon in the movie The Rite. The Hollywood glimpse of the underworld came and went without much notice by moviegoers. But then another form of hell on earth grabbed the headlines. Judgment Day would soon be upon us.
Oh, it will be a horror story beyond measure.
Harold Camping, the doomsday prophet and founder of Family Radio, read between the lines of the Bible and proclaimed that on May 21st, an earthquake would convulse the entire world, time zone by time zone. Christian believers would fly up into the air to meet Jesus. As for those left behind,
there will be weeping and wailing because everybody will realize this is it. Judgment Day has come.
When the day came and went without event, Camping and his followers, some of whom had given up jobs and family to spread the word, had one simple question.
What in the world happened?
Camping argued that a spiritual judgment had occurred. He had a stroke a few weeks later, and his prediction that the earth would be destroyed in October also failed. But if hell did not make a physical appearance on earth, it made a huge splash in the book industry, jump-started by this promotional video from one of the nation's most influential evangelicals.
Will only a few select people make it to heaven? And will billions and billions of people burn forever in hell?
Rob Bell, whose hip, riveting preaching style drew thousands to his church and brought him worldwide fame, wrote a book that takes aim at this fundamental evangelical belief. He says he began thinking about hell when his church put on an art show about peacemaking, and one of the pieces featured Mahatma Gandhi.
And somebody had attached to the piece with Gandhi this handwritten note that said, "Reality check, he's in hell." And it was such a... like, really? That's the gospel of Jesus? That's the good news?
Bell's book, Love Wins, argues that God's grace and love mean that many people, maybe all people, will spend eternity with God in heaven, not just Christians.
Buddhists, Hindus, people of Jewish faith, do I think there will be all sorts of people reconciled to God, present in heaven, however and whatever that is? Of course. The thing I think you'll hear the most in heaven is, wow. That's awesome.
Bell did not argue that hell does not exist. He said people can choose to be in hell by definitively rejecting God's grace. But he says that God is tireless in trying to win every person over, and eventually love wins. This popular message sent Bell's book soaring to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Then came the blowback, and it was hotter than you know what.
Well, first of all, I believe the man is a false teacher. I believe he's a heretic because the Bible's very...
My heart goes out to him because he is really deceived.
So here comes Rob Bell. He's made a Christian gospel for you, and it's perfectly palatable. It's much easier to swallow. That's what you've done, haven't you?
No, I haven't. And there's actually an entire chapter in the book on hell. And there's
That's evangelist Franklin Graham, pastor and author John MacArthur, and MSNBC host Martin Bashir. Bell's book spawned a bevy of new books on hell, pro and con. Among the authors was a friend and pastor, Francis Chan. When he got Bell's book, he was secretly hopeful.
Because I thought, maybe he's right, and I no longer have to worry about this place. I no longer have to warn people about this place. I want to believe what Rob Bell believes.
But when Chan studied the Bible, and particularly Jesus' teachings, he concluded that there is a place of torment called hell. He wrote his book, Erasing Hell, to counter Bell's kinder, gentler message. What happens if Bell is wrong, Chan worries, and people become complacent about their eternal destiny?
If you were going to jump out of a plane and someone threw a backpack on you and say, "Trust me, it's a parachute," and I've opened it up, I go, "No, it's just a backpack." It's not going to work. And so in the same way, if there's this belief that, well, you know what, God's going to let us all go. And I'm going, no, I've looked into the scriptures, and that is not what I see.
For his part, Rob Bell says that this turn or burn mantra distorts Christianity and drives people away from the faith.
What harms people is when a pastor gets up at a funeral and says, hi, everybody, we're here today because Uncle Bob died, and I want you to know for sure that Uncle Bob is burning in hell forever. That hurts people.
So, why is 2011 the year for hell? It's not as if this is a new concept. What's happened, says Lauren Winner at Duke Divinity School, is that Bell's book exposed a debate among evangelicals that's been percolating underground for years. She says younger Christians in particular are squeamish about the idea that their non-Christian friends and family will burn.
If you live next door to a Muslim and you work in a cubicle next to a Wiccan, you may be a very devout conservative Christian, but you may also be very uncomfortable imagining that those people are not going to be with you eternally.
In the end, Rob Bell says, hell remains a mystery.
It's speculation. Like, nobody died and came back with video footage.
Speculation that sparked one of the most contentious debates of 2011. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
A lot of critics, professional and amateur, have spent a lot of time in the last few weeks making best-of lists, movies, trends, gadgets, gaffes. TV critic Eric Deggans wants to note a trend, the triumph of funny women.
Is there anybody on TV more adorable than Zooey Deschanel on Fox's new hit sitcom, The New Girl?
So, you know in horror movies, when the girl's like, oh my God, there's something in the basement. Let me just run down there in my underwear and see what's going on in the dark. And you're like, what is your problem? Call the police. And she's like, okay, but it's too late because she's already getting murdered. Well, my story's kind of like that.
She's playing a woman who's moved in with three guys after a bad romance. We've seen Deschanel play this character countless times over the last 10 years. Quirky, bohemian, earnest, and a little dorky. Fox even coined the term adorkable just to describe her. But she's also the leading edge of a trend that defined television in 2011, the funny female.
I believe paying no taxes can help us return to the America I love.
That's Saturday Night Live's Kristen Wiig playing GOP presidential candidate Michelle Bachmann.
The America of thousands of years ago in which feral bands of mud people lived in their caves, never worrying that Barack Obama was going to come and take their hard-earned pelts or infringe on their right to bear spears. That's my America.
Wiig practically defines the year of the funny female on TV. And not just because she dominated the funniest skits on SNL this year. It's also because Wiig's hit movie Bridesmaids gave a boost to two of television's other female MVPs of comedy, Mike and Molly star Melissa McCarthy and Maya Rudolph from NBC's Up All Night. When other TV shows tanked, Rudolph and Christina Applegate stepped up with their oddball chemistry as a daytime TV star and her executive producer pal, who's also a new mom.
Do not worry, I'm going to fire Nancy.
Yeah?
Yes, of course. I'm a firing machine, honey. That's why they call me the Ray Gun. Pew, pew, you're fired.
You used to be the ray gun, but since you've had Amy, you have lost your edge. Now you've been more like, ray gonna let everything slide.
When you consider who watches TV, this all makes sense. Women typically watch more TV than men, and outside of sports, shows with a high percentage of female viewers also tend to be among television's most successful. Think American Idol and Dancing with the Stars. Comic Whitney Cummings even grabbed two prime spots on the schedule as an executive producer on CBS's Monday night hit Two Broke Girls and star of NBC's Whitney.
I mean, being a comedian is not really a choice. It's just you either have a bad childhood or you don't. And thank you, Mom and Dad, for that.
In January, Cummings' NBC show will be paired with a new sitcom on the life of boozy, sexy comic Chelsea Handler.
You cannot date my ex-boyfriend. That is very slutty.
I would let you date one of my ex-boyfriends.
When am I going to call up Vinny Machado and see what time he gets off at the cigarette factory, and then we can go down to the river and molest each other?
That's right. A double-barrel shot of in-your-face females happy to sling sex jokes just like the boys. It's debatable whether this is such a wonderful leap forward for female images. But just a few years ago, some critics predicted reality TV shows would kill the sitcom altogether. Instead, the rise of the funny female proves network TV's future likely comes with a smile. and a pair of snappy high heels.
Eric Deggans is a TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times.
If you listen to Top 40 music, you've heard her voice all over the place. Skylar Grey. Perhaps this song from February. Yeah! It's so loud. Or this Top 10 hit with Diddy from April. Pick up the phone. Pick up the phone. Or this one from November. NPR's Neda Ulaby reports the 25-year-old musician is heading into next year with a new solo album this spring.
Skylar Grey's great year started last year because of one monster hit she co-wrote for Rihanna. Just gonna stand there and watch me burn. Well, that's all right because I like the way it hurts. Love the Way You Lie spent 7 months on the pop charts.
So after Love the Way You Lie was a big hit, Eminem invited us to go work on Detox, and we gave him I Need a Doctor.
That song slid Skylar Grey closer to her real goal, stardom. She performed it at the Grammys in February with Dr. Dre and Eminem. I need a doctor, call me a doctor. I need a doctor, doctor, to bring me back to life. Skylar Grey is a new name and new persona for a young, bruised music industry veteran. Until recently, Skylar Grey was someone else. Her name was Holly Brooke. She started recording children's music professionally with her mother in Wisconsin when she was only 6 years old.
I learned a lot singing with my mom. It gave me an advantage, I think, as an artist, to have that under my belt, you know. 3 albums by the time I was 15.
Holly Brooke got signed to a major label when she was still a teenager. A strong-willed teenager who got dumped by Warner Brothers by the time her solo album came out. She supported herself singing backup for musicians like Duncan Sheik. He's the guy who composed the musical Spring Awakening, and he cast her in a few other musicals he'd been working on, including one called Whisper House. And now we'll sing
of drowning. She doesn't have, like, this big voice. It's just kind of this actually quite small and quiet, but it's very perfect and beautiful, and her pitch is immaculate.
Holly Brooke decided she needed to leave the business in order to reinvent herself. She moved to a remote cabin in Oregon. She says she lived there for a year without heat, chopping wood, foraging.
I was fearless. It was the first time in my life I'd ever felt like myself, finally, you know. Like, nobody else could control me.
That's when she chose the name Skylar Grey.
Because Holly Brooke to me was a whole, like a, somebody who was controlled by everything around her instead of in control of her own life.
Right now, Skylar Grey's hanging out in a sunlit Hollywood recording studio. She's wearing a scrunched down wool hat and combat boots that look both battered and expensive. She's talking to her producer, Alex the Kid, about a song that's her kiss-off to Holly Brooke.
That's some of my most favorite production of yours, by the way.
Why?
Or one of.
Yeah, why?
Because I really like the sound. That thing that sounds like a crazy sounding guitar is actually him singing. And he, like, puts it through all these effects. And then the beatboxing and...
You know, she just wrote that, and it was like, I don't know, how quickly did you write that?
Very quickly, it just fell out of my mouth. Like, Love the Way You Lie.
That hook, she wrote in 15 minutes. Another song they play in the studio took much longer to write. 2 whole hours. This is your final. Skylar Grey does not like to talk about the veins of violence that run through her lyrics. But she says it might have a small something to do with her industry and how it treats young women.
I'm trying to make a statement as an artist because I feel like right now, where pop culture and pop music has gone is so visual. It's all about, like, the sex appeal, and the music can speak for itself. You don't have to cover it with bling and dumb stuff that doesn't even have anything to do with the music.
She understands that what propels the music industry is exactly what's messed up about it. And the person Skylar Grey invented has set very clear limits of how willing she is to play along. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
2011 was also a good year for swag. Not swag meaning trinkets or party favors or an acronym for stuff we all get. The word swag that had a good year comes from swagger. NPR's Sammy Yenigan reports.
Lil B throws swag on everything. Jay-Z had his back in 2003. Oof, man, I got my swag. And Soulja Boy, he turns it on first thing in the morning. Roughly speaking, if you've got swag, you've got confidence, style, you're charismatic.
This year is the point when it's really started becoming common outside of rap music, so non-musical celebrities are starting to use it more and more.
Check out Jesse Scheidlauer, editor-at-large of the Oxford English Dictionary, swag. He says not only are pop artists like Justin Bieber and Kesha using it, professional athletes are dropping it, and it's popping up on network TV shows like So You Think You Can Dance and Parks and Recreation.
Dilly 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 swag!
Scheidlauer says that swag is swag because you can drop it anywhere.
The core use is as a noun.
This right here is my swag. Swag.
It can be used as a verb.
Taco Bennett right there, swagging.
With the full form, there's the idiom to swagger jack.
Please do not swagger jack me.
Meaning to copy someone's style. But it is showing up in other contexts as well. I mean, for instance, on Twitter, you can use it as a hashtag, just as an interjection-like thing where you can say,
swag, 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 swag.
Meaning, that's great, or something like that. It's very flexible right now.
Swagger has been around for centuries. Scheidlauer says it's rooted in Old Norse. But in English,
the first example of swagger as a verb goes back to Shakespeare, actually. It's found in Midsummer Night's Dream.
What hempen homespuns are we swaggering here?
Now, let's chop off the word's tail and fast forward to spring 2011, where we see a video of Sean Combs, a.k.a. King Combs, a.k.a. Puff Daddy, a.k.a. Puffy, a.k.a. P. Diddy, a.k.a. Diddy, making an important announcement.
My new name is Swag.
And Swag set up a Twitter, at I Am Swag, where he tweeted about things that were, you get the idea. But the name change only lasted a week. Diddy's Diddy again. As for how much longer Swag will last, well, let's just say it had a good year. Sammy Yenigan, NPR News. Swag, swag.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Sammy Yenigan. Thanks for listening.